father, and sent down to us in an oversized hat box.
Route opposite.
Willie was attired in the usual type of clothing worn for every day. It consisted of pants, jacket, white stockings, and low-cut shoes. The white shirt collar was turned down over the jacket, and the cuffs were turned back over the sleeves.
In Abraham Lincoln from Skeptic to Prophet by Wayne C. Temple, quoting Illinois State Journal, July 7, 1871.
We had all of us of the household many times seen that little gray suit on the living boy.
Hilliard opposite, account of D. Strumport, butler.
Little Willie, pathetically wasted, was dressed in one of his old brown suits, white socks, and low-cut shoes, like an ill-used marionette.
Epstein opposite.
He lay with eyes closed, his brown hair parted as we had known it, pale in the slumber of death, but otherwise unchanged, for he was dressed as if for the evening, and held in one of his hands, crossed upon his breast, a bunch of exquisite flowers.
Willis, opposite.
The president came in for a look, only too early. The trestle table was still up. Jenkins was just gathering up the tarp. The tools of our craft were yet visible in the open box. The pump still gurgled. I was sorry for this. It impeded upon the desired effect. The president blanched noticeably, thanked us, quickly left the room.
Route opposite. '89.
The boy sat stock still, eyes very wide indeed.
'90.
They buried Willie Lincoln on a day of great wind that tore the roofs off houses and slashed the flags to ribbons.
Leach opposite.
In the procession to Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown, two white horses drew the hearse bearing the little boy who had known only happiness, but black horses drew the carriage in which sat the worn and grief-stricken president.
Randall opposite.
The gale blew the roofs off tall houses, shattered glass windows, leveled fields of military tents, turned muddy streets into canals, and canals into rapids. Gusts of wind destroyed several churches and many shacks, uprooted trees, blew out the skylights of the Library of Congress. Waves inundated the long bridge over the Potomac to Alexandria.
Epstein opposite.
The father drove, unseeing, through the wreckage.
Leach opposite.
The carriages of the funeral procession stretched for so many blocks that they took a long time to wind their way up to the heights of Georgetown and to the beautiful Oak Hill Cemetery with its crown of oak trees.
Kunhardt and Kunhardt opposite.
When the head of the cortege reached Oak Hill Cemetery by way of Washington Street, it was found necessary, because of the length of the line, to route a part of the line along Bridge Street into High Street. Climbing the hill past the new high-level reservoir, it turned into Road Street and proceeded eastward to the cemetery, where the body of William Wallace Lincoln was to be placed in the vault of W.T. Carroll on Lot 292.
In Essay on the Death of Willie Lincoln by Matilda Williams, Curator, Peabody Library Association.
Now all was still, and the hundreds of people climbed out of their carriages and walked through the gates of the cemetery to the beautiful little red stone Gothic chapel with its blue-stained windows.
Kunhardt and Kunhardt opposite.
At one moment the sun came out and, pouring in through the small windows, painted everything inside with a blue glow, as if at the bottom of the sea, causing a small pause in the prayers and a feeling of awe among the congregants.
Smith Hill, opposite.
Here, over the coffin, more prayers were said by Dr. Gurley.
Kunhardt and Kunhardt, opposite.
We may be sure. Therefore, bereaved parents and all the children of sorrow may be sure that their affliction has not come forth of the dust, nor has their trouble sprung out of the ground. It is the well-ordered procedure of their Father and their God. A mysterious dealing, they may consider it, but it is still His dealing. And while they mourn, He is saying to them, as the Lord Jesus once said to His disciples when they were perplexed by His conduct, "What I do, ye know not now, but ye shall know hereafter."
Gurley, opposite.
And there sat the man, with a burden on his brain at which the world marvels, bent now with the load at both heart and brain, staggering under a blow like the taking from him of his child.
Willis, opposite.
The president rose, approached the coffin, stood there alone.
In the Dark Days by Francine Kane.
The tension and grief in the chapel were palpable. The president's head, as he spent these last precious moments with his boy, was bent. In prayer, weeping, or consternation, we could not tell.
Smith Hill, opposite.
In the distance, shouting. A workman, perhaps, directing an effort to clean up after the cataclysmic storm.
Kane, opposite.
The president turned away from the coffin, it appeared by sheer act of will, and it occurred to me how hard it must be for the man to leave his child behind in a place of such gloom and loneliness, which never, when responsible for the living child, he would have done.
In private correspondence of Mr. Samuel Pierce by permission of his estate.
He seemed to have aged greatly in the last few days. Many sympathetic eyes and prayers being directed at him, he appeared then to come to himself and left the chapel, a most distressed look upon his face, but not yet giving way to tears.
Smith Hill, opposite.
I went up to the president and, taking him by the hand, offered my sincerest condolences. He did not seem to be listening. His face lit up with dark wonder. "Willie is dead," he said, as if it had only just then occurred to him.
Pierce, opposite. '91.
The lad stood.
Emerging in this way from Mr. Lincoln.
Turned to us.
Stricken look on his pale round face.
"May I tell you something?" he said. How I loved him in that moment. Such an odd little fellow. His long swoop of forelock, roundish, protruding belly, rather adult manner. "You are not sick," he said.
Suddenly all was nervousness and agitation.
"That thing in my box," he said, "has nothing to do with me."
Individuals began edging toward the door.
"I mean, it does," he said, "or did. But now I am something quite apart from it. I cannot explain."
"Stop talking," Mr. Vollman said. "You will kindly stop talking at once." "There is a name for what ails us," the boy said. "Do you not know it? Do you really not know it?"
Many were now attempting to flee, causing a bit of a jam at the door.
"It is quite amazing," the boy said. "Stop," Mr. Vollman said. "Please stop, for the good of all." "Dead," the boy said. "Everyone, we are dead."
Suddenly, from behind us, there occurred, like lightning cracks, three rapid-fire repetitions of the familiar, yet always bone-chilling, fire sound associated with the matter-light-blooming phenomenon.
I did not dare to look around to see who had gone.
Dead, the lad shouted, almost joyfully, strutting into the middle of the room. Dead, dead, dead! That word. That terrible word.
Purdy, Bark, and Ella Blow were flailing within a window casement like trapped birds, weakened and compromised by the lad's reckless pronouncements.
Verna Blow stood below, pleading with her mother to come down.
Now look, Mr. Woolman said to the boy, you are wrong. If what you say is true, who is it that is saying it? Who is hearing it? I said. Who is speaking to you now? Said Mr. Woolman. To whom do we speak? I said.
But he would not be silenced.
Tore away years of work and toil with each thoughtless phrase.
Father said it, he said. Said I am dead. Why would he say that if it weren't true? I just now heard him say it. I heard him, that is, remembering having said it. We had no answer for this.
It did not indeed seem to us, knowing him as we now knew him, that Mr. Lincoln would lie about such a momentous thing. I have to say it gave me pause. In my early days here, I only now recalled, I had, yes, for a brief period, understood myself to be—
But then you saw the truth, saw that you moved around and spoke and thought, and that, therefore, must be merely sick, with some previously unknown malady, and could not possibly be.
It gave me pause.
I was good, the lad said, or tried to be. I want to do good now, and go where I should. Where I should have gone in the first place. Father will not return here, and none of us will ever be allowed back to that previous place.
He was hopping with joy now, like a toddler too full of water. Look, join me, he said. Everyone, why stay? There's nothing to it. We're done, don't you see?
Purdy, Bark, and Ella Blow, within the window casement, went, in a triply blinding blast of the matter light blooming phenomenon.
Followed quickly by Verna Blow, there below, unwilling to endure as she had been made to endure for so long in that previous place, an existence without her mother.
I knew it! The lad shouted. I knew something was off with me.
His flesh seemed thin as parchment. Tremors ran through his body.
His form, as sometimes happens to those about to go, began flickering between the various selves he had been in that previous place. Purple newborn, squalling naked infant, jelly-faced toddler, feverish boy on sickbed.
Then, with no change in size at all, i.e., while still child-sized, he displayed his various future forms, forms he had, alas, never succeeded in attaining. Nervous young man in wedding coat, naked husband, wet-groined with recent pleasure, young father leaping out of bed to light a candle at a child's cry, grieving widower, hair gone white, bent, ancient fella with an ear trumpet athwart a stump, swatting at flies.
All the while seeming quite innocent of these alterations.
Oh, it was nice, he said sadly, so nice there. But we can't go back to how we were. All we can do is what we should.
Then, drawing a deep breath, closing his eyes,
he went.
The lad went.
Never before had Mr. Woolman or I been so proximate to the matter-light blooming phenomenon and its familiar but always bone-chilling fire sound.
The resulting explosion knocked us off our feet.
Squinting up from the floor, we caught a brief last glimpse of the pale baby face, a pair of anticipation-fisted hands, an arched little back.
And he was gone.
His little gray suit lingering behind, for the briefest instant.
92.
I am Willie. I am Willie. I am even yet. Am not Willie. Not Willie, but somehow less. More. All is allowed now. All is allowed me now. All is allowed light, light, light me now. Getting up out of bed and going down to the party, allowed. Candy bees, allowed. Chunks of cake, allowed. Punch, even rum punch, allowed. Let that band play louder. Swinging from the chandelier, allowed. Floating up to ceiling, allowed. Going to window to have a look out, allowed, allowed, allowed. Flying out window, allowed, allowed. The entire laughing party of guests happily joining behind me, urging me to please, yes, fly away, saying, oh, he feels much better now. He does not seem sick at all. Whatever that former fellow, Willie, had, must now be given back, is given back gladly, as it never was mine, never his, and therefore is not being taken away, not at all. As I, who was of Willie, but is no longer merely of Willie, return. To such beauty.
93.
There in his seat, Mr. Lincoln startled.
Like a schoolboy jolting suddenly awake in class.
Looked around.
Momentarily unsure, it seemed, of where he was.
Then got to his feet and made for the door.
The lad's departure having set him free.
So quickly did he move that he passed through us before we could step aside.
And again, briefly, we knew him.
94.
His boy was gone. His boy was no more.
His boy was nowhere. His boy was everywhere.
There was nothing here for him now.
His boy was no more here. Than any place else, that is. There was nothing special anymore about this place.
His continued presence here was wrong, was wallowing.
His having come here at all a detour and a weakness.
His mind was freshly inclined toward sorrow, toward the fact that the world was full of sorrow, that everyone labored under some burden of sorrow, that all were suffering. That whatever way one took in this world, one must try to remember that all were suffering. None content, all wronged, neglected, overlooked, misunderstood. And therefore, one must do what one could to lighten the load of those with whom one came into contact. That his current state of sorrow was not uniquely his, not at all, but rather, its like had been felt, would yet be felt, by scores of others, in all times, in every time, and must not be prolonged or exaggerated, because in this state he could be of no help to anyone. And given that his position in the world situated him to be either of great help or great harm, it would not do to stay low, if he could help it.
All were in sorrow, or had been. Or soon would be.
It was the nature of things.
Though on the surface it seemed every person was different, this was not true.
At the core of each lay suffering, our eventual end, the many losses we must experience on the way to that end.
We must try to see one another in this way.
As suffering, limited beings.
Perennially outmatched by circumstance. Inadequately endowed with compensatory graces.
His sympathy extended to all in this instant, blundering in its strict logic across all divides.
He was leaving here broken, awed, humbled, diminished.
Ready to believe anything of this world,
made less rigidly himself through this loss.
Therefore, quite powerful.
Reduced, ruined, remade.
Merciful, patient, dazzled.
And yet.
And yet, he was in a fight. Although those he fought were also suffering, limited beings, he must
obliterate them.
Kill them, and deny them their livelihood, and force them back into the fold.
He must, we must, we felt, do all we could in light of the many soldiers lying dead and wounded in open fields all across the land, weeds violating their torsos, eyeballs pecked out or dissolving, lips hideously retracted, rain-soaked, blood-soaked, snow-crusted letters scattered about them, to ensure that we did not, as we trod that difficult path we were now well upon, blunder further. We had blundered so badly already. And, in so blundering, ruin more of these boys, each of whom was once dear to someone. Ruin more, we felt, must endeavor not to ruin more. Our grief must be defeated. It must not become our master and make us ineffective and put us even deeper into the ditch.
We must, to do the maximum good, bring the thing to its swiftest halt and
kill.
Kill more efficiently.
Hold nothing back.
Make the blood flow.
Bleed and bleed the enemy until his good sense be reborn.
The swiftest halt to the thing, therefore the greatest mercy, might be the bloodiest.
Must end suffering by causing more suffering.
We were low, lost, an object of ridicule, had almost nothing left, were failing. Must take some action to halt our fall, and restore ourselves to ourselves.
Must win the thing.
His heart dropped at the thought of the killing.
Did the thing merit it, merit the killing? On the surface, it was a technicality, mere union, but seen deeper, it was something more. How should men live? How could men live? Now he recalled the boy he had been, hiding from father to read Bunyan, raising rabbits to gain a few coins, standing in town as the gaunt daily parade drawled out the hard talk hunger made, having to reel back when one of those more fortunate passed merrily by in a carriage, feeling strange and odd, smart too, superior, long-legged, always knocking things over, called names, Ape Lincoln, Spider, Apeham, monstrous tall, but also thinking, quietly, there inside himself, that he might someday get something for himself. And then, going out to get it, he had found the way clear. His wit was quick. People liked him for his bumbling and his ferocity of purpose, and the peach orchards and haystacks and young girls and ancient wild meadows drove him nearly mad with their beauty, and strange animals moved in lazy mobs along muddy rivers, rivers crossable only with the aid of some old rowing hermit who spoke a language barely English. And all of it, all that bounty, was for everyone to use, seemingly put here to teach a man to be free, to teach that a man could be free, that any man, any free white man, could come from as low a place as he had. A rutting sound coming from the cane cabin. He had looked in through the open door and seen two pairs of still, socked feet and a baby toddling past, steadying herself by grasping one of the rudder's feet. And even a young fellow who had seen that and lived among those might rise here as high as he was inclined to go. And that, against this, the king types who would snatch the apple from your hand and claim to have grown it, even though what they had come to them intact or been gained unfairly, the nature of that unfairness perhaps being just that they had been born stronger, more clever, more energetic than others, and who, having seized the apple, would eat it so proudly they seemed to think that not only had they grown it, but had invented the very idea of fruit, too. And the cost of this lie fell on the hearts of the low, Mr. Bellway rushing his children off their Sangamon porch as he and father slumped past with that heavy bag of grain drooping between them. Across the sea, fat kings watched and were gleeful that something begun so well had now gone off the rails, as down south similar kings watched. And if it went off the rails, so went the whole kit, forever. And if someone ever thought to start it up again, well, it would be said, and said truly, the rabble cannot manage itself. Well, the rabble could. The rabble would. He would lead the rabble in managing. The thing would be won.
Our Willie would not wish us hobbled in that attempt by a vain and useless grief.
In our mind, the lad stood atop a hill, merrily waving to us, urging us to be brave and resolve the thing.
But we stopped ourselves short. Was this not just wishful thinking? Weren't we, in order to enable ourselves to go on, positing from our boy a blessing we could not possibly verify? Yes. Yes, we were.
But we must do so and believe it, or else we were ruined.
And we must not be ruined.
But must go on.
We saw all of this in the instant it took Mr. Lincoln to pass through us.
And then he was out the door and into the night.
95.
We black folks had not gone into the church with the others. Our experience having been that white people are not especially fond of having us in their churches, unless it is to hold a baby, or prop up or hand fan some old one. Then here came that tall white man out the door right at me. I held my ground as he passed through and got something along the lines of, I will go on. I will, with God's help. Though it seems killing must go hard against the will of God. Where might God stand on this? He has shown us he could stop it, but has not. We must see God not as a him, some linear rewarding fellow, but an it, a great beast beyond our understanding, who wants something from us, and we must give it. And all we may control is the spirit in which we give it, and the ultimate end which the giving serves. What end does it wish served, I do not know. What it wants, it seems, for now, is blood, more blood, and to alter things from what they are to what it wills they should be. But what that new state is, I do not know. And patiently wait to learn, even as those 3,000 fallen stare foul-eyed at me, working dead hands, anxiously asking, what end might this thing yet attain that will make our terrible sacrifice worthwhile? Then he was through me, and I was glad. Near the front gate stood Mr. Havens, square in that white man's path, as I had been, but doing then something I had not the nerve nor desire to do.
96.
I don't know what came over me. Never in that previous place had I been a rash person. What need had I to be? Mr. Connor and his good wife and all of their children and grandchildren were like family to me. Never was I separated from my own wife or children. We ate well, were never beaten. They had given us a small but attractive yellow cottage. It was a happy arrangement, all things considered. So I don't know what came over me. As that gentleman passed through, I felt a kinship and decided to stay a bit. Therein. So there we were, moving along together, me matching him step for step, which was not easy. His legs were long. I extended my legs to match his and extended all of myself. And we were the same size and out upon horseback. And forgive me, the thrill of once again riding a horse was too much, and I stayed. Therein, what a thrill it was to be doing what I wished, without having been ordered to do so, without having sought anyone's permission. The ceiling of a lifelong house flew off, if I may put it that way. I knew of the instant vast tracts of Indiana and Illinois, full towns in their complete layout and the nature of the hospitality of specific houses therein, though I had never been in either of those places, and came to feel that this fellow, well, my goodness, I will not say what office it seemed to me that he held. I began to feel afraid, occupying someone so accomplished, and yet I was comfortable in there, and suddenly wanted him to know me, my life, to know us, our lot. I don't know why I felt that way, but I did. He had no aversion to me, is how I might put it. Or rather, he had once had such an aversion, still bore traces of it. But in examining that aversion, pushing it into the light, had somewhat already eroded it. He was an open book. An opening book that had just been opened up somewhat wider by sorrow and by us, by all of us, black and white, who had so recently mass inhabited him. He had not, it seemed, gone unaffected by that event, not at all. It made him sad, sadder. We had, all of us, white and black, had made him sadder with our sadness. And now, though it sounds strange to say, he was making me sadder with his sadness. And I thought, well, sir, if we are going to make a sadness party of it, I have some sadness about which I think someone as powerful as you might like to know. And I thought then, as hard as I could, of Mrs. Hodge and Elson and Litzy, and of all I had heard during our long occupancy in that pit regarding their many troubles and degradations, and called to mind as well several others of our race I had known and loved. My mother, my wife, our children, Paul, Timothy, Gloria, Rance P., his sister B., the four little Cushmans, and all the things that they had endured, thinking, sir, if you are as powerful as I feel that you are, and as inclined toward us as you seem to be, endeavor to do something for us so that we might do something for ourselves. We are ready, sir, are angry, are capable. Our hopes are coiled up so tight as to be deadly or holy. Turn us loose, sir. Let us at it. Let us show what we can do.
97.
Elson and Litzy had been by the chapel door, listening in. Now they trot skimmed over, holding hands. That little white boy, Litzy said. Said we are dead, said Elson.
Goodness, said Mrs. Hodge.
All these years in our pit, I had treasured up the notion that some day Annalise and Benjamin, my children, would what? Join me? Some day join me? Here? It was ludicrous. Suddenly I saw just how ludicrous. Poor me. Poor me all of those years. They would never join me here. They would age and die and be laid to rest there in those far-flung locales to which they had been taken when taken from me. They would not come here. And anyway, why would I want that? I had wanted it somehow while I only waited, believing myself paused. But now that I knew I was dead, I wanted for them only to go to where they should, directly there, wherever that was. And feeling that way, saw that I ought to go there myself. I looked at Litzy in our old way, as if to say, "Lady, what do you think?" "I'll do what you do, Mrs. Hodge," Litzy said. "You always been like a mother to me."
Sad, though. I'd only just got my voice back, and now it was time to leave.
"Elson," I said. "No," he said. "If such things as goodness and brotherhood and redemption exist and may be attained, these must sometimes require blood, vengeance, the squirming terror of the former perpetrator, the vanquishing of the heartless oppressor. I intend to stay here until I've had my revenge upon someone." Such a dear boy, so proud, so dramatic. "We are dead," I said. "Here I am," he said. "I am here." I said no more, for if he wished to stay, I would not impede him. We all must do what we like. "Ready," I said to Litzy. As if for old time's sake, she gave me the double-eyed blink, which had always meant yes.
'98. Dear brother, a postscript. After writing the above, went to bed. Sometime later woke to sound of horses' hooves. I summoned Grace, and she helped me into the wheeled chair and to the window. And who should be leaving but Mr. L. himself, I swear it, looking ever so weary and stooped in the saddle as he rode away. I opened the window and shouted down to good old Manders to confirm. It was indeed the president. What must be the extent of his heartache for him to have come here at this cold and cruel hour of the night? Now I must have Grace help me back to bed. I'm doing my best to summon her only when necessary, as she has been out of sorts with me lately, always in a bad temper and never jolly with me anymore, as if sick of me, and who could blame her? It is not happy to be at the beck and call of one so immobilized. And I cannot blame her, for I recently am having more pain, and my good spirits often compromised. But she is no friend. Of this I must constantly remind myself. She is hired by us to care for me, and that is all. Brother, when do you come home? I know you wander for your own purposes, but find it hard to believe you are not lonely, or perhaps you have charmed some prairie lady. Your sister is tired and lonely and sick. Do you not love me? Do you not wish to see me again? Please come home. I do not wish to alarm you. Do not say these things to force you home, but feel so poorly lately, weak and drifting in mind and unable to eat. Is it not right that we who love one another should be together? Please come home. I miss you so, and have no real friend here in this place. Your loving sister, Isabel. 99.
As Prez emerged from chapel, I hightailed it out of guardhouse to unlock gate. Prez went out saying nothing, seeming distracted, reached over, gave my forearm warm squeeze, then hopped upon the back of his little horse, and I thought whole caboodle might go over on its side, but no, that little horse hero, stealing himself, clopped away, quite dignified, as if he meant to protect Prez's reputation by acting as if Prez's feet were not nearly scraping the ground. And I tell you, Tom, that noble nag might have been bearing Hercules or G. Washington for all the pride in his step as they disappeared down our street into chilly night. As I was locking back up, Tom had feeling of being watched, and looked up and saw that our mystery girl from across the street sat her faithful post at her window, and lifting said window from her sitting position with considerable effort, called across to me Was that Prez who just rode off? And I called back, yes, indeed. And it was sad, Tom, as I have known her or seen her at least since she was a little girl, who could still walk and run with all the others. Now she must be nearly 30. And feeling kindly inclined toward her now, I called up that she best shut the window for the cold, for I'd heard she was not well, and she thanked me for my concern and said it was a sad thing, wasn't it, about Prez's son. And I said, oh, very sad, indeed. She said she thought the child must surely be in a better place. And I said I hoped so and prayed so. And our voices hung there as if we were last living souls on earth. And good night, said I. Good night, said she. And brought her window down, and soon enough, her light went out.
100.
A mass exodus from the chapel ensued. Our cohort fleeing out through all four walls at once.
Many succumbing, even while in motion.
Mr. Bevins and I rushed out together, as the inky night around the chapel lit up with multiple instances of the matter light blooming phenomenon.
All was chaos.
The pale smock of the beautiful raped mulatto floated down, still stained with bloody handprints at the hips.
Followed by the large, unoccupied dress of Mrs. Hodge.
The air was filled with curses, shouts, the hissing velocity sounds of our dear friends desperately rushing away through bushes and low-hanging trees.
Several had been so severely infected with doubt that locomotion now became impossible.
These slumped wearily against stones, crawled weakly along pathways, lay draped and broken-seeming across benches, as if dropped from the sky.
Many succumbing from these undignified positions.
Now, across the chapel lawn, charged Lieutenant Stone.
Heading directly for Mr. Farwell.
Clear the way! Cease contaminating this holy place, Shard! As I'm the man among all here who's been in this place the longest, the number of my knights here being beyond 20,000, and the number of souls who, coming to this place, have, through cowardice and flinching, since departed anon by my latest count nearing 900. Who shall manage things here if not me? And I will be damned, and damn good, if the current chaos shall be exploited by a Shard man as an excuse to loaf.
Even the lieutenant's extreme self-confidence seemed affected by the recent confusion. For he did not grow any taller during this diatribe, and seemed even to shrink a little.
The lieutenant ordered Mr. Farwell back to work, back to whatever work had been assigned him by whichever white person had assigned it, at which time Mr. Farwell seized the lieutenant by the collar and threw him roughly down upon his back.
The lieutenant demanded to know how Mr. Farwell dared touch a white man in anger, and commanded Farwell to let him up. Mr. Farwell refusing, the lieutenant kicked Farwell in the chest, and Farwell flew back, and the lieutenant leapt to his feet and, straddling Farwell, began beating him about the head with his fists. In desperation, Farwell groped about for a nearby pathstone and swung it into the lieutenant's head, causing the lieutenant to fall to the ground and his tricorn to fly off. Farwell then positioned one knee upon the lieutenant's chest and used the stone to smash the lieutenant's skull into a flat, pulpy mass, after which he stumbled away and sat on the ground disconsolately, head in hands, weeping.
The lieutenant's head quickly reforming, he revived and, catching sight of the weeping Mr. Farwell, barked out that he was not aware a Shard could weep, since to weep one must possess human emotions, and again ordered Mr. Farwell back to work, back to whatever work had been assigned him by whichever white person had assigned it, and again Mr. Farwell seized the lieutenant by the collar and threw him down upon his back. And again the lieutenant demanded to know how Mr. Farwell dare touch a white man in anger, and commanded Farwell to let him up. And, Mr. Farwell again refusing, the lieutenant again kicked Farwell in the chest.
And so on.
It was still going on as we fled the scene.
Showed no signs of abating.
Was proceeding with a fury that suggested the two might well fight on into eternity.
unless some fundamental and unimaginable alteration of reality should occur.
101.
Mr. Vollman and I ran skim desperately toward our home places.
Shaken.
Even we were shaken.
Even Mr. Bevins and I were shaken.
Brother, what are we to do? I called over. Here we are, Mr. Vollman called back. Look at me. Here I am. Who is it? Who is it that speaks? Who is it hears my speaking? But we were shaken.
We came now upon the disreputable barons, collapsed in a heap atop the Constantine sick mound, an unremarkable limestone slab, cracked at one corner, marred by bird droppings over many decades.
For someone long ago had planted a small tree overhead to shade Constantine from the sun.
Get up! Get up! No fucking stopping! No fucking thinking!
I ain't! I ain't fucking thinking! I just don't feel good.
Look at me. Look at me. Remember that time we lived in that fucking beautiful field? With the kids? That, spacious meadow? In that tent? Remember that? After fucking Donovan evicted us from that shithole by the river? Those were the days, huh?
That was no fucking spacious meadow, you piece of shit. That was where all the fucking scum of the earth came to shit and dropped their goddamn garbage.
But what a view, huh? Not many kids get that view. We could look out our tent flap, and right there, the fucking White House.
But first, you had to walk around the goddamn trash heap while watching out for those big fucking rats and that gang of Hessian gropers that fucking lived in there.
They never groped you, though.
Bullshit! I had to burn one fucker's leg with a shovel full of hot coals to get him off me. Came right in the fucking tent, in front of the fucking kids. No wonder they never come see us. We've been here. How long we been here? A pretty fucking long time, and they never come once.
Fuck them, right? Those fucking ingrate snakes have no goddamn right to blame us for a fucking thing until they walk a fucking mile in our goddamn shoes, and neither fucking one of the little shitheads ever walked even a...
Eddie, no. They was our kids. We fucked it up.
No fucking sad shit. And no fucking stopping. No fucking thinking. You know why? We want to fucking stay. Got plenty of celebrating left to fucking do, right?
Eddie. We're fucking dead, Eddie. Love you. You fucking fucker.
No. No, 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 don't. Don't do it. Stay the fuck with me, kid.
Her flesh became thin as parchment. Tremors ran through her body. Her form flickered between the various selves she had been in that previous place, too debauched and impoverished and shameful to mention, and then between the various future forms she had, alas, never succeeded in attaining. Attentive mother, mindful baker of bread and cakes, sober church attender, respected, soft-spoken grandmother surrounded by her adoring, clean brood.
Then came the familiar, yet always bone-chilling, fire sound associated with the matter-light-blooming phenomenon.
And she was gone.
Her threadbare and malodorous clothing raining down all around.
Mr. Barron let loose a prodigious howl of obscenities and succumbed, albeit reluctantly, compelled by his inordinate affection for that lady, the color of his matter-light-blooming phenomenon, not the usual luminous white, but rather a dingy gray.
Smelling of tobacco, sweat, and whiskey, his clothes came raining down.
And a racing form, and an obscene cartoon.
102.
Suddenly, Mr. Bevins did not look well. His flesh was thin as parchment. Tremors ran through his body.
So many memories were flooding back. I recalled a certain morning, the morning that I had seen Gilbert at the baker's. Yes, I had, my God. He was Ah, most painful. He was with someone. A man. Dark-haired, tall, broad-chested. Gilbert whispered something to him, and they shared a laugh, at my expense, it seemed. The world went flat. It seemed a stage set built for the telling of a specific joke to be told on me. Having been born with my propensity, I would find Gilbert, come to love him, but would not be able to be with him, for he wished to live correctly. And then the punchline, me, crestfallen in that baker's doorway, loaf in hand, the two of them approaching, pausing, the whisper, the laugh. And they broke around on either side of me, this new fellow, he was so beautiful, raising an eyebrow as if to say, that? That is him? Then another killing laugh burst. I rushed home and proceeded.
Mr. Bevins dropped to his knees. His form flickered between the various selves he had been in that previous place. An effeminate but affectionate young boy, much fussed over by a family of sisters. A diligent student crouched over multiplication tables. A naked young man in a carriage house, reaching over to tenderly kiss that Gilbert. A good son, posed between his parents for a daguerreotype on the occasion of his birthday. A red-faced, distraught disaster, tears rolling down his face, butcher knife in hand, porcelain tub in his lap. "Do you remember," he said, "when I first came here, you were so kind to me, calmed me down, convinced me to stay. Do you remember?" "I was happy to be of service," I said. "I just remembered something else," he said, in a tone of wonder. "Your wife once came to visit."
"I do not recall any such occurrence," Mr. Volman replied stiffly. "My wife, believing my recovery best aided by a period of solitude, prefers not to visit." "Friend," I said, "enough. Let us speak honestly. I am remembering many things, and I suspect that you are too." "Not at all," Mr. Volman said. "A plump, beaming woman came here," I said, "a year or so ago, and recounted many things, happy things concerning her life, her numerous children, her excellent husband, and thanked you, imagine, for your early kindness to her, which had, as she put it, allowed me to deliver myself unsullied to he who would prove to be the great love of my life. She thanked you for placing her on the path to love, and for never, never once being unkind to her, but always gentle and dear and considerate. A true friend, she called you." Tears were rolling down Mr. Volman's face. "She did you the honor, sir, of coming to say goodbye, and standing at your grave, explained that she would not, in future, be able to join you there, as she must instead, eventually, lie beside this new fellow, her husband, who was, please, Mr. Volman said, who was much younger, I said, than you. Closer, that is, to her own age. You, Mr. Volman said abruptly, you cut your wrists and bled to death on your kitchen floor. Yes, I said, yes, I did. Many years ago, he said. So many years ago, I said. Oh, God, Mr. Volman said, and his flesh grew thin as parchment, and tremors ran through his body, and his form began to flicker between the various selves he had been in that previous place, fresh-faced apprentice in an ink-stained smock. Young widower wiping away tears for his first wife, fingernails blue-rimmed with his work despite an obsessive pre-funeral scrubbing. Lonely, middle-aged fellow with no hopes at all, who only worked and drank and, in a depressed state, occasionally whored. A heavy-set, limping, wooden-toothed 46-year-old printer glimpsing from across the parlor at the wickets upon New Year's Day, a radiant young woman in a lime dress, little more than a girl, really. And in that moment, he felt himself no longer old, but young, interesting, vital, dashing, and for the first time in years, felt he had something to offer, and someone to whom he hoped he might be allowed to offer it.
"Shall we?" Mr. Bevan said. "Shall we go together?" And assumed his various future forms, forms he had never, alas, succeeded in attaining. A fine-looking young man on the prow of a ship, gazing off at a row of yellow and blue houses, just coming into view upon a distant shoreline. And on that voyage he had been fucked, and fucked well, by a Brazilian engineer who had taught him much and given him much pleasure. And now Mr. Bevins knew that that life was for him, whether it be good or not in God's eyes. The contented lover, for many years now, of a gentle, bearded pharmacist named Reardon. A prosperous, chubby, middle-aged fellow, nursing poor Reardon through his final illness. An old geezer of nearly 100, blessedly free of all desire, for man, food, breath, being driven to church in some sort of miracle vehicle, before which stood no horse, and which went about on rubber wheels, loud as some perpetually firing cannon.
"Yes, all right," Mr. Woolman said. "Let us go. Together."
And it seemed we had passed the point of choosing. The knowledge of what we were was strong within us now, and would not be denied.
And yet something held us back.
We knew what.
Who?
Of one mind now, we flu-skimmed east, erratically caroming off boulders and hillocks and the walls of stone homes, like wounded birds, feeling nothing but urgency to reach our destination. Flickering on and off, weak and growing weaker, sustained barely by some lingering, dissipating belief in our own reality. East and east and east, until we reached the edge of that uninhabited wilderness of some several hundred yards
that ended in the dreaded iron fence.
103.
The trainer girl lay, as usual, trapped against and part of the fence, manifesting at that moment as a scaled-down, smoking wreck of a rail car. Several dozen charred and expiring individuals trapped within her, barking out the most obscene demands, as Miss Trainor's wheels turned mercilessly upon several hogs, who, we were given to understand, had caused the crash, and possessed human faces and voices, and were crying out most piteously, as the wheels turned and turned and crushed and re-crushed them, giving off the smell of burning pork.
We had come to apologize.
For our cowardice at the time of her initial doom.
Which had always, in every minute since, gnawed at us.
Our first huge failing.
Our initial abandonment of the better nature we had brought with us from that previous place.
Standing outside the burning car, I called in. "Can you hear me, dear?" I shouted. "There is something we wish to say."
The train shifted a bit on its tracks and flames leapt up, and several of the hogs who had caused the crash turned to us, and, in a beautiful American dialect that came out of their perfectly formed human faces, told us in no uncertain terms that she could not and would not be saved, and hated it all, and hated us all, and if we did indeed care for her, why not leave her alone, for our presence aggravated her already considerable torment, reminding her, as it did, of the hopes she had held in that previous place, and of who she had been upon first arriving here.
A spinning young girl.
In a summer frock of continually shifting color.
"We are sorry," I shouted in. "Sorry that we did not do more to convince you to go, back when you still had the chance." "We were afraid," Mr. Bevan said. "Afraid for ourselves." "Anxious," I said.
anxious that we might fail in our endeavor. We felt we must conserve our resources, Mr. Bevins said. We are sorry this happened to you, I said. You did not deserve it, Mr. Bevins said. And sorry especially that we did not stay to console you as you